Welcome to Frankly Speaking, where we aim to solve any business owner problem anywhere at any time. I'm Alan Franks, and today I'm going straight into a topic that can either accelerate your wealth building or quietly sabotage it. I'm talking about your biggest expense, taxes. My guest is John Mitchell, host of Legal Talk, former IRS appeals officer, tax attorney at J. Mitchell Law Firm PC, and one of only 10 people nationwide to earn the United States Tax Court Practitioner designation. He's prepared over 10,000 tax returns and handled more than $100 million in IRS tax controversies. John, welcome to the show.
Man, oh man, I am so happy, Christian, to be here. This is, this is a dream come true, man. I'm overflowing with joy and so happy to be with you and be able to share some really good information for your audience, man. Ready to rock and roll.
Hey, John, as I mentioned to you, a lot of people would look at tax and law and maybe fall asleep, but not me, brother. I'm here. This is my wheelhouse. I love this stuff. I cannot wait to jump in with you. So let's start. And hey, I want this to be really practical. So let's start with some hidden leaks that people really feel every single year. So in this discussion, I want to set up the foundation that we're talking about here with taxes. Obviously, we're coming up on April, but it's not just an April event. It's a year-round event here. So I want to see some mistakes that people make when focusing on some income and capital gains tax, but oftentimes they're ignoring the structure, the timing, and the documentation of it. So let's hop on in with the first question. When you look at the average successful household or business, where are you seeing the most avoidable tax leaks?
You know, one of the things I see I guess the number one thing I wish people knew when they walked in my office, right? I wish people knew just what you said, and you hit the nail right on the head. So congratulations on that. Taxes is not just an April 15th thing, right? Taxes, this planning, it's a marathon, not a sprint. And so one of the things that I see people, that could maybe do a little bit better is to realize that, right? It's a year-round thing. You should be probably having meetings with your tax person, your financial person, at least 2-3 times a year, probably, maybe even quarterly, right? So, go to the dentist, go to the tax guy. It's going to be about as painful either way, but it's going to be worth it in the end, right? Because the dentist is going to make sure your teeth don't fall out, and your tax guy is going to make sure that the government does not pick your pocket, or at least, not as much as they could, right? You're going to organize your affairs. You're going to plan. You're going to make sure that you're able to get in there and have some good planning so that you can hang on to more of your hard-earned money, and that's what I get so much joy from helping people to do.
Wonderful. So Vince Lombardi said that winning is not a sometimes thing, it's an all-the-time thing. John T. Mitchell just said, hey, tax planning is not an April 15th thing, it is an all-year thing. So you and Vince, phenomenal right there. So and let's talk about this. What is the difference between tax preparation and tax strategy?
In my practice, as in so many tax-focused law firms, we even code it differently in the billing software, right? There's two different kinds of activities. There's tax preparation, which is a compliance type activity, right? So you're just trying to keep in compliance. You're trying to fill out the right paperwork, make the proper disclosures, pay the proper amount. That's compliance. That's just you, doing the bare minimum to make sure that you're not in trouble with the IRS and with the government as a whole, right? And that's the important thing, and it's perfectly fine. But I would caution people to not just look at taxes as a compliance issue, right? Supreme Court Justice said, and God, I should probably know this. I don't remember off the top of my head which Supreme Court Justice wrote this in an opinion. He said, everybody has the right to organize their affairs in such a manner as to minimize the amount of taxes that they're legally obligated to pay, right? And so when I look at that, I focus on the first part of that phrase, right? So you have the right to go ahead and organize your affairs organizing your affairs, that's the key point here. Mm-hmm. So the difference between just tax compliance and tax planning, the planning allows you to go ahead and organize your affairs so that in the end, when you do the tax return, i.e. fill out all the paperwork and write the check is as small as it could possibly be within the bounds of the law.
Yep. And it's funny the name, tax preparation, right? Well, preparation to me seems proactive, but oftentimes we're finding CPAs, people that are filing these taxes, are extremely reactive. Is that what you're finding as well?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, man. I mean, when you talk about tax preparation, that is not proactive at all. That's reactive. Yep. That's, you know, you're dealing with numbers that were generated in the past, right? Yes. Like when somebody comes to me to help them do their tax return, what's the first thing I ask them for if they're a business? Well, I ask them for their profit and loss. I ask them for a balance sheet. I ask them for, you know, maybe their last 12 months bank statements. That all that stuff's in the past, man. Yep. Planning is going to deal with what's coming up in the future.
That's right. That's right. And the truth is a lot of CPAs have gotten old. They've retired. A lot of young people are no longer studying accounting. There's a lack of CPAs that are coming in. So even if they can do tax strategy, their capacity from a time perspective is very limited to actually do so on there.
That's right. And that's one of the reasons why I tell people all the time, you know, to go ahead and try and understand as much as they can. Right. If you're a business owner, you know, I know it's painful, man. I know it's painful, but dig in there and try and understand as much as you possibly can. That way you're not, you know, you're starting off, you know, with a little bit of momentum behind you when you go see that tax guy. Because like you said, certainly CPAs, especially, you know, fewer people are going into the field. And it's definitely that's one of the challenges.
Hey, if you were to look at your cash flow statement and you see that 30 cents of every dollar is going to this person named Uncle Sam, and you know where I am, you know, 5.85 to Aunt Georgia, right? 5.75 to Aunt Georgia. You would look into that, right? If there was a utility bill, if your water bill was 30%, you would look into ways to lower that water bill. I think a lot of people just kind of assume that taxes and death are the two certainties in life, and they don't realize that, frankly, death might be a lot more imminent than what a lot of business owners think, and maybe taxes might be a little bit more voluntary than what other business owners might think, right? So having somebody like you in their corner to help them with these strategies to, A, lower their and mitigate their taxes, but also to keep them out of jail, which we'll talk about here in a second, right? It's important to have those allies on your team.
Absolutely. Now, you know what I always say about that whole death and taxes thing, right? Very true. But you know, the problem is death, you only have to go through it once. Taxes is every year, man.
That's right. That's right. So, hey, let's talk about taxes here. Let's talk about Uncle Sam and the IRS. You've been inside the belly of the beast here. What do taxpayers misunderstand the most about the IRS and how it prioritizes cases and enforces the tax law? I'm Alan Franks, host of Frankly Speaking, only on Now Media Television. We're here with one goal and one goal only. Our aim is to solve any business owner problem, anywhere, anytime. Join me for my next episode of Frankly Speaking, only on Now Media Television.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people, one of the things I see is a lot of people don't understand one of the fundamental structure of the IRS, right? Now, when I was at the IRS, I was in the Independent Office of Appeals, so I was an appeals officer. And a lot of times people would come in and they want to, you know, be all tough and aggressive with me. And I would have to kind of calm down and tell people, look, man, I am not the guy that's trying to collect money from you. I'm the guy that's going to, you know, hear you out. You feel like you haven't gotten a fair shake so far. That's why you filed on appeal, and that's why you're here in front of me, right? And so I'm the guy that's going to help you out. Appeals is your best friend at the IRS. But people talk about IRS agents. Well, Really, there's two different kinds of front-facing organizations within the IRS. So there's the examination function, and their job is to make sure that the correct amount of taxes has been calculated, right? And so then there's the collection function. So once the amount of taxes has been determined, now the collection guys, revenue officers, so revenue agents are on the examination side, revenue officers are on the collection side, and of course then you've got appeals. And so one of the things that is usually kind of helpful for people to figure out what function, how's your strategy, how are you going to attack this IRS problem, one of the things is to understand which part of the IRS is contacting you today, right? Like, who are you dealing with? Are you dealing with somebody that's going to, pop open a spreadsheet and try and calculate the correct amount of taxes that you owe? Now, there's an important thing, and you can all look this up on Google. Publication one, right? Publication one, that is the taxpayer bill of rights. It's 10 rights. You look it over, understand it, and that is a basis for a lot of what I do, because one of your rights as a taxpayer is to not pay any more than the correct amount of tax that is due. And so that's very important. If you think that the amount of tax the IRS is asking you for is wrong, then certainly you have a right. And that's also another right under the Taxpayer Bill of Rights, the right to have your position heard by the IRS and have them listen to you, to your side of things, right? Very, very important. I had a case recently pop up a couple of months ago where a young lady had just started a business with a partner, and the IRS, all of a sudden sent her a bill for $100,000. And she said, well, why I don't even understand, why am I getting this bill, et cetera, right? But turns out when she registered that company, she told the IRS that she anticipated, right? And here's my emphasis on that word, anticipated. She anticipated having employees. Now, in reality, she ended up not hiring any employees, but the IRS is sitting there thinking, well, there's going to be this list of employees. I should be getting tax returns. I should be getting payroll tax returns on these employees. So since there were no returns filed, i.e. because she didn't have any employees, right? But she should have filed at least zero, returns with zeros in there as a placeholder, because IRS said, well, we're just going to estimate what you owe. And we estimate it's $100,000. So pay us. And so I had to step in and kind of help fix that problem. So, one of the biggest also things that I can recommend to people, make sure that if you have any kind of issue, any kind of hiccup, any kind of trouble, even a little speed bump, right? Make sure that you attack that early on and do what you got to do, because the problems that might crop up tax-wise, they are much easier, i.e. and also cheaper. If you talk about easier, you talk about cheaper. So they're cheaper and easier to fix early on rather than to let them sit there and fester.
So let me ask you this, John, because you've worked there, and I think the IRS in itself has become something of a political hot rod here where they're almost the boogeyman. But from my understanding, my perspective, they're what I would call the tax police. They didn't set these tax codes. They're just trying to catch the people who are abusing them against the law and trying to enforce these tax codes. And obviously, if you're abusing the law, you'd be afraid of the tax police. If you're staying within the law, it's actually a rather good thing, because it's making certain that everybody, including yourself, if you're paying your taxes, making sure everybody else is paying their taxes. Is that a poor analogy there, or would you agree with that?
I would mostly agree with that, and I would just add the little caveat that one of the reasons why people are afraid of the IRS, let me just put it this way, right? If I'm driving down the freeway and the speed limit is 70, I know whether I'm over 70 or under 70, so I just look down and it's right there in front of me on my speedometer, right? Mm-hmm. Now, I might look up and see some flashing lights at the distance behind me, and I know the speed limit's 70 and I'm doing 90, Oh, okay, there's the problem in the pit of my stomach, right? It's a very easy thing to determine. Yeah, I'm over the limit. Now, the problem that a lot of people have is, with the IRS, taxes are complicated, man.
Yeah.
Last time I checked, Internal Revenue Code was something like 17,000 pages, code and regulation, right? And so a lot of the problem is people sit back and think, well, holy crap, I think I'm doing things right, but I hope I'm doing things right. But what if there's something I'm missing? And so that little piece there is what's kind of missing. In that analogy, I would say, just make sure, like people don't know. So it's fear of the unknown is part of it also.
And also the fear of, you're not going to know immediately if you're doing something right. You might not even know next year. It might be 3 or 4 years into the future where all of a sudden an agent gives you a call, right? Or an officer gives you a call and says, hey, you owe taxes, penalties, interest, things of that nature, which can be really, really daunting to somebody who's never dealt with this before.
Exactly, yeah. And by the time you found out, the penalties and interest have added up so much, and you're like, doggone it, if I had known this before, I could have done something about it. I could have fixed this before, before the problem grew, kind of, right? So there's that.
Yep. Well, hey, let's go back to people and their taxes and things that they can take away here. What are you finding the biggest mistakes that people are making when filing their taxes that's making their tax bill larger than it otherwise should be?
One of the things is people don't want to, and I understand this, right? Money's tight, times are hard. A lot of times people want to go the do-it-yourself route, but think about this. Would you ever watch a YouTube video and buy some medical supplies on Amazon and have them delivered, and then you're gonna mask up and try and do your own appendicitis, right? Your own appendectomy, right? And start cutting on yourself, right? I watched a couple of YouTube videos. I ought to be good to go. I'm gonna save all this money, right? And so a lot of times what people don't want to do is spend money on getting some professional assistance with that, right? One of the things I always say, look, I would not try to go into my kitchen this weekend and tear out all the cabinets and rebuild my kitchen cabinets, because you know why? Because my kitchen cabinets are going to end up all crooked. Right? They're not going to be right because I don't know how to do that. Right? And so one of the things is know your limits, right? And get that professional help, because it can certainly be a lot cheaper for you to spend a few a few hundred dollars consulting with somebody that knows, and get that get that path properly planned out ahead of time, rather than to try and fix problems that cropped up later because things weren't done quite right.
Totally. Totally. So that leads right into the next question. Hey, if we want viewers to take one action this week that lowers their risk and improves their outcomes, what's one of the things that has the highest ROI here?
Well, one of that is a high ROI, like I said, to get a tax professional involved early on
It's not
in
that
your planning.
expensive. It's not that expensive, yet it's amazing how few people actually ask for that help. It is getting more expensive though, John. There's less and less CPAs. We used to be able to find somebody do a return for $350. Shoot it. Now it seems like $1,250 is the minimum out there. So there certainly are maybe some W-2 people that, filing their own taxes might make sense for them. But when we start getting into higher incomes, particularly business ownership, maybe some real estate stuff, come on, guys, hire a professional in here, right, John?
Yes, sir. Yeah, it's going to be cheaper in the long run to just get that professional assistance. I agree with you there, sir. Look, if I've got nieces and nephews, and my family, all the nieces and nephews, everybody wants Uncle John to do their taxes, right? And I do that for them, and they pay maybe 10% what a normal client would pay, right? But they've got also these tax returns with one or two W-2s. They got a couple of kiddos. It's pretty basic stuff, right? And so if you make $30,000-$40,000 a year and you got a W-2 or two, you know, you can probably get by with doing, you know, something either H&R Block or maybe doing TurboTax Online or whatever it may be, right? I don't dispute that if your taxes are that simple. But, you know, once you start cropping up and you got yourself a side hustle, that's a business, you got some rental properties, you got some investments, yeah, it's probably, you know, it's probably time to upgrade and, you know, and bite the bullet and get something and get some professional help.
That's right, particularly when that income tax starts, you know, ticking up there. All of a sudden, we got an income tax problem, right? Well, wonderful. Well, hey, coming up, I'm going to ask John to walk me through what really happens when the IRS comes a knocking here and how smart people respond without making it even worse. I'm Alan Franks, host of Frankly Speaking, only on Now Media Television. We're here with one goal and one goal only. Our aim is to solve any business owner problem, anywhere, anytime. Join me for my next episode of Frankly Speaking, only on Now Media Television. Welcome back to Frankly Speaking. If you want more conversations like this, stream Frankly Speaking and your other Now Media TV favorites live or on demand. Download the free Now Media TV app on Roku or iOS and catch the podcast version anytime at nowmedia.tv. Now I'm back with John Mitchell, and now we're getting tactical because the truth is most people don't get crushed by the IRS. They get crushed by the wrong reaction to Uncle Sam and the IRS. So, let's talk about making decisions under stress. What to do first, what to avoid, and how an appeals mindset changes the outcome. John, let's hop in. Let's say someone gets an IRS notice today. They get a love letter from Uncle Sam, their least favorite relative. What's the first 48-hour game plan that you recommend before they call anyone?
Man, oh man, let me tell you, right? I have been at this for 30 some years now, right? And one of the things, I used to have a CPA friend of mine. He's, you know, he's deceased now, but he was a good old guy. And he used to tell me, John, he says, you know, when the clients walk in your office and they go to the conference room, you know, they got this supermarket plastic bag full of, you know, correspondence and receipts and stuff. And, you know, they dump it out on your conference table. Man, he says, you know, your first thing, you have to separate the dead bugs on one side and the IRS correspondence on the other, right? And, you know, I've seen it 100 times. People walk in, they got big stacks of letters, you know, this thick from the IRS. And guess what they are? They are unopened, my friend. And so I will tell you, the very first thing, if you get a letter from the IRS that you recognize is from the IRS, not time to panic, man. It's time to get your letter opener and open that sucker up, right? You're going to read it and try your best to understand it. I know it looks like it's in hieroglyphics, right? But it's not. Trust me, it looks more complicated than it is. And I'll give you this pro tip, man. If you get a letter from the IRS, usually in the upper right-hand corner or the lower right-hand corner, there will be a notice number or a letter number. You know, it'll say LT11 or it'll say, you know, CP2000, right? CP2000 is one of the most common ones. And that just means there's been some kind of an arithmetic type error on your tax return, right? Something either didn't get added in, something didn't get subtracted, whatever. You know, your calculator was on the fritz and they've, you know, found some kind of calculation error on your tax return, right? But I'll tell you this pro tip. If you go to irs.gov, irs.gov, right? That's the official IRS website. Search bar in the upper right-hand corner, you can type in that letter number, and it will give you on the screen a plain English explanation of what that letter is all about and what kind of things you might want to do with that, right? And so that's the very first step. Do your best to open your letters, look at them, read them, and try and understand what's going on. That's step number one. Step number two, if it's a minor thing, if they're sending you a letter and saying, yeah, we've crunched the numbers and you owe us an extra $100, you know what? It's probably not worth it to come to a guy like me and pay $500 or $1,000 for me to sit with you and try and correct a $100 problem, right? So that, I mean, that's on you. If you want to do it, it's your right to, you know, to challenge things or whatever, right? But definitely, you want to make sure that you at least try your best to understand what's going on, and then if the situation warrants it, right? If in your judgment, if in your mind it's worth it to, you know, find somebody like me, then, you know, go ahead and do that, and do it early on rather than to wait. Because I give you this other little piece of advice, right? This is for everybody out there. If you don't pay attention to anything else in this segment, pay attention to this, right? I'm not telling you to ignore any IRS correspondence, right? That's not what I'm saying. But when things start coming certified mail, when you see that green certified mail sticker on the front, that is a red flag for you, sir and ma'am. You know, jump in there and really pay attention, because when they start sending stuff to you by it's regular mail, that's one thing. I'm not saying ignore it, but when they get to certified mail, really set up and notice, because guess what? They're trying to tie down and they're trying to make a paper trail. They're making a record of when did they notify you of things, when did you receive that, and usually that's because the clock starts ticking on some kind of right that you have to challenge it. And so certified mail is a big one.
Man, I'm so glad that you said that, because I'm certain our listeners here have gotten a letter in the mail from the IRS. And man, it changes my whole day. I'm coming home from work. I'm feeling good. About to go and see my family. Stop by the mailbox. Get some letters out. IRS, send me one. But now, if there's not a green stamp in the top left or wherever saying certified, I want to relax. I know it's small potatoes here. We need to open it. We need to respond. But, you know, as long as it doesn't have a green stamp, I'm good. I appreciate that, right? So let's talk about panicking. So I to this day, and I think most business owners feel this way, whenever they get a letter from Uncle Sam, their heart just drops to the pit of their stomach. They haven't even opened it yet. Could be, hey, you get a refund. Who knows, right? But what are some of the most common panic moves that you see that turn into a future management problem here that you've got to go back and clean up for?
You know, I've seen it be where people will get correspondence from the IRS, and they'll, you know, hide it from their spouse. They'll, you know, drop it in the shredder or whatever and hope that it goes away. And this will not go away. If you've got an issue, it's most likely probably not going to go away on its own. So, you know, be proactive and take those steps to take care of that is my biggest takeaway, I guess.
Gotcha. So, hey, let's get into the appeals process here. So as a former IRS appeals officer, what actually persuades appeals and what almost never works?
Man, oh, man, you know, I'll tell you what. The thing that almost never works is to come in there with some kind of an emotional argument. Oh, it's not fair, right? Mm-hmm. Or I've seen people try and argue, well, you know, my friend's brother's cousin, you know, made as much money as I do, and he paid way less taxes. Why is that, right? Well, I'm sorry, I can't tell you that, right? Like I would have to see your friend's brother's cousin's tax return and put it side by side with yours, and then I can do a line by line comparison. I can tell you why he purportedly paid less tax or didn't pay less tax or whatever, right? And so emotional arguments or things about, oh, it's just not fair. I might on a human level, if I were still back at the IRS, on a human level, I might feel for you, but that's not going to mean that's going to translate into some kind of relief for you. Yeah. So when I was at IRS appeals, the main thing that we are looking for is evidence, right? So whatever documentation you have to back up your position, that's key, right? Mm-hmm. If the IRS examination function, if we think that they screwed up and disallowed a deduction, for example, well, it's a lot easier for me to write up my closing memo and push it up the line to my management for approval if I can show them some kind of documentation to back up your whatever it is you're claiming, right? Yeah. Yeah. So that documentation is key.
And take me into the mind of an officer that's reviewing this. You're probably just trying to close the case out as quickly as possible. You're not trying to play gotcha IRS, hey, we got to pay this now. It's more or less, hey, if you show us that we were wrong, we'll escalate this and we'll get this corrected. Am I right in thinking?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I can tell you this. When I was with the IRS, we are absolutely not graded or in any way, like it was not even, we didn't even keep track of how much money did you collect or how much, how many extra tax burden did you impose on people? No, it is 100%. How quickly can, when I went to work there, my trainer told me, John, if you want to be successful in IRS appeals, your number one focus is how fast can you get this case off your desk and keep it off, yep. Right? And yep. So that's what we're graded on. They have metrics and they track officer by officer how many days did you have that file in your hands. And the quicker you close out cases, the better. Mm. And so, one of the things I like to do being on this side of the table, if I have a case that I know I'm going to take really to any IRS function, but especially appeals, what I try and do is I try and take my big machete, not a real machete, don't get me wrong, right? Like, I'm not going in there with machetes, right? Don't think that. My metaphorical machete, right? And chop my way through the brush in the jungle and try and lead that officer down the path that I want him to go, right? And so I'm try to make it as easy as possible on them. I try to, write very clear memos. I try to put all the backup documents. Everything's very organized. It's Exhibit A, Exhibit B, Exhibit C to back up the things that I'm claiming, right? And so I try and make a path that I want them to go down. And that's a very, I think, a very worthwhile thing that anybody can do with or without a professional at your side, right?
Yeah.
If you're going to go it alone, at least, try and be very clear and make it just super crystal clear what you're going after. Yeah. What is your argument and what's the backup to that argument?
Love it. So, hey, we're in the appeals process, right? When should someone consider solutions like a payment plan, penalty abatement, or maybe a compromise there? And as a person who maybe owe money to the IRS, how do you know which lane you're going to end up being in?
Well, that is, I mean, we could go on for hours about that, but I'll break it down as simple as I can, right? You hear these things on the radio, pennies on the dollar, right? Well, yeah, that kind of exists, but it's, the devil's in the details, so to speak, right? So, if the IRS's collection function has a stated goal, right, and it's in their manual, it says collect as much of the tax as you can, as soon as you can, right? And now if you're going to talk about a collection alternative, let's say an installment agreement, a partial pay installment agreement, offering compromise, if it's based on ability to pay, right? So the argument of the taxpayer is, I can't afford to pay the whole thing right now, right? Mm-hmm. Then IRS will calculate what they call a reasonable collection potential, RCP. And that is going to guide you. If your RCP, in other words, if they calculate they can collect the full amount that you owe, they're not going to accept a partial payment. They're not going to make a deal for you. Oh, hey, you owe us 10 grand, but hey, we'll let it go for five because it's Tuesday and I'm in a good mood. No, that's not the way that goes. It's very strict guidelines. And you go through and fill out the right paperwork, back it up with documentation, and then if you're entitled to a reduction in the amount that you owe, then yeah, they'll go ahead and do that, but you got to justify it. Yep. And so this is not Uncle Sammy's used car lot where you go and say, well, I'll tell you what, I'll give you, you know, X amount. I'll actually spit in your hand and shake the hands with them. And that's your deal of the day, right? That's not the way that works, right? Reasonable collection potential. So any kind of a payment option that you're trying to work out with the IRS has got to be justified. And there's rules and regulations behind that.
Yeah. I'm Alan Franks, host of Frankly Speaking, only on Now Media Television. We're here with one goal and one goal only. Our aim is to solve any business owner problem, anywhere, anytime. Join me for my next episode of Frankly Speaking, only on Now Media Television. So let's seemingly, if we have a large tax bill due, then we probably have the means potentially to pay for that, but we may not have the cash on hand. Talk to me about going into a payment plan with the IRS. What typically does that look like from the length of time? And obviously interest rates will change, but how do they figure out what that interest rate will be on that loan?
Well, you know, there are published interest rates, and so it's prime rate plus, I don't remember, I think it's like 3%, so prime plus 3 or whatever. The devil in the details of that is, by the way, the way the interest is compounded, because it's compounded daily. So that's, that it's kind of, it seems deceptively small when you just look at it by interest rate, right? So there's that. And so payment plans, they will enter into a payment plan for you because there's a couple of different ways this can go. Think about a fork in the road, right? If it's a relatively small amount of money that you owe, let's say you owe the IRS. And when I say small amount of money, I'm talking about small to them, right? Yep. So small amount of money to the IRS, if you are less than $10,000, then you can propose to them any payment plan you want, and they'll accept it as long as the taxes are paid in full by the statutory end date, right? So statute of limitations with the IRS, you got a statutory end date for how long they have to collect that debt, right? It's called a CSED, they call it. And so long as you're paying in full before the statutory end date, then you're good to go, right? If it's under $10,000, that is automatic approval of whatever it is you want to do. I want to pay $100 a month. I want to pay $200 a month, whatever it may be. Boom, they're going to approve it, and it's going to go, it's going to go, right? Now, up to, I think it's $50,000, you can get most payment plans approved as long as it's paid before the due date. But, being that the number is a little bit higher, now they're going to want you to fill out some paperwork and justify exactly why you can't pay it, right? Mm-hmm. And if you propose a payment plan that the monthly payment is less than what they calculate by their guidelines that you can afford, then they'll come back at you with a counter proposal. Hey, IRS, I owe you $20,000. I'd like to pay $500 a month. I send them my bank statements and pay stubs, all that good stuff. And they might come back and say, okay, $500 is acceptable, good to go. Or they might say, no, John, we're looking at your finances here and we think you can pay $800 a month. So it's going to just depend, right? So it's based on ability to pay. And since the numbers are a little bit bigger, they look at it a little bit more closely, right? Yep. And then once you get up into higher numbers, six-figure numbers, that's more levels of scrutiny. Yep. And, and another consideration is your payment plan going to pay off the balance in full, or there exists what is called a partial pay installment agreement. So I owe $100,000 to the IRS. At the amount of money that I can afford to pay per month, I'm only going to pay $80,000 before the statute expires and my debt falls off, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're going to be a lot more careful about approving something like that.
Totally. 100%. So you mentioned something about the statute of limitations with the IRS. So let's talk about documentation discipline. What do business owners, high income earners, what do they need to keep? How long do they need to keep it? And why is it so important that they keep these documents?
Right. Well, you know, there's a thing that we call a burden of proof, right? And so if I'm going to fill out my tax return and say that I spent $11,000 this month on travel expenses, right? If they call me and ask me to prove that, I've got to be able to offer up proof, right? So whoever is asserting the thing has an obligation to prove it, right? Mm-hmm. So if I say I had $11,000 worth of travel expenses and they call me in for an audit, I better be able to show them receipts for $11,000 worth of travel expenses, right? Mm-hmm. And so that is an important thing, right? So anything that demonstrates something that affects your tax calculation, that would be your income, and that would mostly be, deductions, right? So any of those things, you're going to want to keep that, and you're going to want to keep it. You know, the standard people usually say is 6 years, 7 years, whatever it may be. I mean, storage is not expensive like it used to be. You don't have to keep warehouses full of paper anymore. You can scan things, and then it's digital, and then it basically takes up no space at all. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, theoretically, you can hang on to things. I have business records going back 20 years, right? And they're all scanned, and they're on a, you know, they're on a disk drive, and that's how I keep it, right? So, definitely you want to keep things as long as the IRS could come back and audit you, right? Usually 6 years. So we say keep things for 7 years and then you can get rid of it safely.
Wow. And is a credit card transaction, is that enough evidence, or do you need the actual receipt from the hotel that you stayed at for that business conference?
You might get lucky and the examination function might, the revenue agent might accept a credit card receipt, but they shouldn't. They're not supposed to, right? You really need to kind of close the circle, right? And a lot of times they want to see the hotel receipt, and then they want to see the credit card statement where that came out of your out of your credit line, and then they want to see some payments from your bank account showing that you paid the credit card.
Wow!
Right, so you make like a complete circle. That's and it's going to depend on who you get. It's going to depend on facts and circumstances. Is that expense that they're checking, is that a big part of your tax return, or is it something that is a relatively small, an insignificant item, right?
Yeah. And following up on that, because I think that's very practical to a lot of business owners, and I'll be honest with you, I'm being selfish in asking this question right here, right? So does that mean every dinner out, we need a receipt here? And the clients that you've represented, how many of them often have the receipt, the credit card transaction, and which is easier to find, and showing them paying it off? Really, it comes down to, hey, did they actually store and can they find that receipt? So what percentage of your clients have been able to do that? And have you found any tools or technology that's made that a little bit easier?
Yeah, I mean, you know what I do in my office, and this is, kind of old school. My staff makes fun of me for it. It works for me, though. When I have a business lunch or business dinner or whatever, I go to the restaurant, I eat, I talk business, and then at the end, I have them bring me the receipt. That receipt, I save it. And at the end of the day, or more likely end of the week, I'll go ahead and attach that receipt to a piece of paper, 8.5 by 11 piece of paper, that is going to have, because meals are subject to a little bit more scrutiny. And God, I hope I'm not wrong about this. I think it's code section 174, where it talks about the additional requirements for certain types of business deductions, right? And meals are in that because it's got a high possibility of being abused, right? And so I have a little form in my office that says, and you got to keep this, right? What was the, so I went out to eat for business purposes. Who was at that business dinner or business lunch? Who was in attendance, and what was the purpose of it? What was discussed, right? And so I'll fill out that little form and attach the receipt to it, and then we can scan that and keep that in the business records, so that if the IRS ever comes back and says, "Hey, John, on June 11th, you're claiming that you went out to a business lunch, spent $100." Well, what was that for? I should be able to go to my images, flip through, and say, "Oh yeah, June 11, I was with Bob Smith, and we were talking about the new marketing plan that we're instituted for our firm, right?" Yeah. And that's that's the kind of record keeping that they would really want to see for something like that.
So, John, if somebody needs help, and if they need help, they're going to need help yesterday, right? What is the best way that they can reach out to you and reach out to J. Mitchell Law Firm?
Right. Well, you can go to my website. So it's www.99-taxhelp.com, right? So, you can find all of our information there. You can look at my bio and my nice picture that's on there and stuff. You can do that. The other way, you could give us a call. That's 1-800-998-2943. So that spells out tax help if you actually spell it out like we used to do in the old days, right? Or shoot me an email. AttorneyMitchell@pm.me is a good public facing email I have. And, I try and get back with everybody within the next day or two, whatever. Sometimes it takes a little while because a lot of times I'm backed up, back to back meetings, all day, and I can't get back to you till tomorrow. But we do our best. But that's a couple of good ways to get a hold of me.
Awesome. Thanks so much for sharing that. And up next, y'all, I want to switch from defense to offense here and talk about the strategies that entrepreneurs and high earners can use to reduce taxes legally while also staying audit resilient.